the first time I remember myself actually smiling at my garbage man, frankly, it was a self-conscious smile. It was like an effort. I was aware of what I was doing.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't until later that day when I saw a pregnant woman, I just reflected back on how automatically I smiled and connected at her. That inside of my smile was sort of an unstated statement that I was appreciating her joy, her adventure, her contribution. And I really became aware of the contrast between the self-conscious smile to the garbage collector and my automatic, loving, connecting smile to the woman.
That came so easily.
That came so easily, yeah. And I realized how I had never in my life supported any garbage man with a smile that expressed appreciation for his contribution. Although, when I thought about it, here he is supporting what the pregnant woman creates and carrying a different load.
I like that. He supports what the pregnant woman creates and carries a different load. But what else did you see differently?
Well, as I got to the supermarket and was sorting through chicken breasts, I always remember, normally speaking, I'd been more aware of the crimes committed against chickens than the crimes committed against the workers that were preparing the chickens. You probably remember the incident of the 2,000 workers at the Morrell meatpacking plant, that 800 of them had become disabled in 1 year. Some of the workers at the Morrell plant were chopping and carving at a rate of 1,000 movements per hour. And when I thought about 40% of these workers being disabled enough to leave their jobs for a year, and each worker's hand essentially being a time bomb.
Now, are you implying here that most of these workers were men?
In the 57 highest risk jobs at Morrell, almost 90% were men. But I think that was what was more astonishing to me was that dozens of these men who had to undergo surgery that required 1 to 2 months for their hands to heal, were instead required to work immediately after the surgery.
Not to make light of any of this, Warren, but it sounds like it's almost enough to make you into a vegetarian.
Yes, until you start thinking about the vegetables. If you think about vegetables being sprayed with parathion, and the parathion is sprayed on the vegetables by about 90% men who are flying planes or are in tractors, and as they fly the planes over the vegetables, and the parathion gets sprayed over the vegetables, the wind usually blows it right back into their faces, which is why they die so early. And that's, in a sense, a microcosm of the entire agriculture industry. I used to think of the agriculture industry as being one where, you know, in farmers, the man and the woman work side by side.
Uh-huh.
In fact, 24 out of 25 of the people who are killed in agriculture are men, and agriculture is the second most dangerous industry.
Wow. Well, what kind of impact did this have on you personally when you go to have a meal at night?
Well, it's almost embarrassing because, like, even if I have a microwave dinner, I will literally be, I'm probably the only person in the country that has this reaction, but I mean, I literally feel thankful about the vegetables in the dinner and the sacrifices that were made, the meat, also the way the dinner was packaged, and the people that, you know, that trucked it to me. I mean, I just think to myself, here I am in 3 minutes preparing something that's costing me very little of my time and very little of my money, and all these people have, in a sense, worked for me and in many cases risked their lives for me. I just feel this enormous amount of gratitude.
You know, you have a picture in The Myth of Male Power of men, migrant workers, sleeping on the hillside in your town of Encinitas outside San Diego.
Yes, that picture struck me after I came back from shopping at the Lucky Supermarket on Encinitas Boulevard near San Diego, and I counted about 30 migrant workers in less than a six-block period. Each of them were looking soulfully into the eyes of every passerby. I'll never forget the look on a man's face as the two men he was standing with were picked up as he was left behind.
And almost all of these migrant workers standing out there waiting to be picked up are men, aren't they?
Of the 1,000 or so that I've seen in my 10 years of living in Encinitas, all of them have been men. I see some of them sleeping at night in the hills, and I'm really touched at how most of these men are sending a good part of their wages back to their children and their wives back home in Mexico, whom they see only once or twice a year before once again risking imprisonment by illegally crossing the U.S. border. We have no men's movement calling these men oppressed for providing money for women, from whom they're receiving neither cooking nor cleaning, and for providing their wives with homes while they sleep on the ground.
When a field worker is radicalized, he is taught to see the classism
Exactly, but he remains blind to the sexism. When we call Mexican men patriarchs as if the rules of their society serve them at the expense of women, it is really we who are being the sexists.
Yeah, I see your point. Okay, well, this has been quite a trip so far. But I think what I learned most from this section of the book, The Myth of Male Power, was what you recalled when you encountered the fire truck.
When I heard the siren of the fire truck, it was like it allowed me to recall how firefighters' death rate from cancer has increased 400% more than for the population at large, and how the average age for cancer death rates among firefighters is 52.
You know, I think all of us had always figured that the danger for firefighting, what firefighters were dying from, was from the smoke and from the fire.
Me too. But when I read about the cancer rate, I remembered how, back to the MGM Grand Hotel fire in Las Vegas some years ago, how it had left 70 people lying dead in almost sterile rooms, untouched by fire and unclouded by smoke. That was my first awareness that it was really plastics that created more danger when they went to fire because of the toxic emissions. That created more danger than the fire or the smoke per se.
Well, wouldn't oxygen tanks and breathing equipment reduce that danger?
Yes, but breathing equipment reduces communication, and oxygen tanks take about a minute to put on. And, for example, in the Grand Hotel fire, the flames moved as fast as 1,000 feet in 1 minute.
You're saying that many firefighters choose to forfeit their own lives to save others?
Yes, or more accurately, to put their lives at risk. And beyond all of that is the issue of volunteerism. When I was a male feminist so ardently, and I blocked out the fact when I heard the feminists talk about women being the ones who always volunteered and worked for free, and that volunteerism was a woman's issue, I blanked out the fact that 80% of all municipal firefighters in America are volunteers, and 99% of those are males.
Mm-hmm.
If we acknowledge women's contribution as volunteers, I think it would also be helpful to appreciate the uniqueness of a million men exposing themselves to death to save the lives of strangers, and all for no pay.
Yes, a little appreciation balancing here.
Yes, and actually the balancing reminds me of probably the last insight that I had on the trip. I pulled into my driveway, and I saw some movers balancing this large couch through my neighbor's doorway. And I could hear what I gather was a father warning his son. The father was saying, watch the way you lift, or you'll end up with a lower back like mine. As I walked into my house, I had a different appreciation for how the refrigerator and all my file cabinets were moved.
So these were all the services that were performed by men that were invisible, which is interesting because we think of women traditionally as doing all the invisible work.
Yes. In fact, a friend of mine who read a first draft to this chapter chastised me for leaving out the contribution of coal miners. And when I said I didn't see the evidence of that around me every day, he corrected me and he said, no, you see the evidence of mining around you all the time every day. It's just the miner who's invisible to you. You don't see him around you every day.
Explain.
He told me to look in the mirror while I was shaving and to check out the fillings that contain not only gold and silver, but mercury and petroleum composite. He corrected my tendency to think of mining just as coal mining rather than also as metal mining and oil and gas extraction.
Ah.
He then explained how my eyeglasses contained not only metal, but also plastic, and the plastic contained metal and coal, and how every time I turn the light on, it is shining through glass bulbs containing tungsten, mercury, and phosphorus, and even the electricity to produce the light comes through copper and aluminum wires from generators, and the generators are also made of copper, and they're spun by tungsten turbines, which are powered by steam that is produced from uranium, or from coal, or from oil.
Okay, so the next thing you're going to be telling me is that your clothes are made from miners.
Well,
as a matter of fact, the metals being?
Usually iron and or limestone or coal.
Okay, what makes mining so dangerous?
Rocks falling from mine ceilings that cause concussions, dangling electrical wires that electrocute miners. You can just imagine if in an office situation we had ceilings falling in that were killing secretaries,
uh-huh,
the electrical wires dangling that were electrocuting secretaries, how much we in this country would be caring about workplace safety.
Right.
And how much the secretaries would be suing the companies if they were the victims of electrocutions rather than dirty jokes.
Well, you know, being aware of all these things, now how do you sleep at night?
I have to relax by just watching a half hour of TV to unwind. I used to watch the news, but I couldn't even watch the story of the war on drugs without being aware of how every Drug Enforcement Administration agent that's ever been killed has been a man. And therefore, being aware of the fact that the war on drugs is really another virtually all-male war. At least in the combat zone, it is all-male. So now I watch sitcoms.
Why don't we do more about workplace safety?
In part because safety costs money. Letting men die is a money-saving device. We're in a country where we still care more about saving whales than saving males.
And when we start caring more about saving males than saving whales?
We'll do more to enforce safety standards for males and less to subsidize smash face for males.
I guess the ultimate example of hiring men on the cheap would be the mandatory draft, no?
Definitely. And this is universal. As Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes put it, every society rests on the death of men. When we live in the United States, we can attribute the fact that we are not under Nazi rule in part to the fact that almost one out of three American men is a veteran. We sometimes forget the number of men who sacrificed their lives. In one World War battle alone, the Battle of the Somme, more than 1 million men were killed or maimed. And that was just on the Allied side. Before men can vote, men have the obligation to protect that right. Women receive the right to vote without the obligation to protect that right.
Do you think we still send the message to men that they are the sex that should prepare for war?
Definitely. When we make a laughingstock out of Dan Quayle when he tried to escape his obligation, and when the country sees that Bill Clinton experienced a 20% drop in the polls after it was revealed he tried to avoid the draft for a war he didn't believe in, even though most of the country now feels that that war was both a mistake and immoral, then I think we can see that we still put pressure on men not to make individual choices of conscience and morality, but rather we put pressure on them just to sacrifice their lives. You might protest that, you know, that the real problem was how Quayle and Clinton handled the situation about their war record, but the sexism comes from no one even asking Geraldine Ferraro for her war record. And therefore her not ever having to be in the position to have to handle the situation. Throughout the world, the basic message to men still is a willingness to serve your country as president, prime minister, vice president is not good enough. If you're a man, you must be willing to prove yourself, that is, willing to die, even if you don't believe in the cause, before you may serve your country in a way you do believe in. I think there's no form of sexism that is more damaging, more unconstitutional, more universal, or more ignored than that form of sexism.
Well, I understand that now 11.7% of our military consists of women. Doesn't this mean we're moving towards less discrimination?
Very minimally. We are still psychologically preparing boys to become insensitive by giving them the rewards of money and love when they participate in violent sports when they're young. Sports like football, boxing, ice hockey, auto crashing, the auto racing, and so on. We still take longer to pick up our boy infants than our girl infants, meaning that we're signaling still to our sons that complaining won't solve their problems. We still circumcise boys' penises without anesthesia, while we would consider it correctly, I believe, abhorrent to do the same to an infant girl's clitoris. And on, we're still preparing boys psychologically to not feel.
So you're saying that that's what creates the psychological preparation that still leaves us with 90% of the armed services being men. Will the armed services be a higher percentage of women as women have more equal opportunity in the armed services?
Actually, the armed services have two major areas of discrimination still against women and numerous major areas of discrimination against men in relation to women.
The two areas of discrimination against women being?
First, the most important one is women entering a system of rules that are basically an outgrowth of the male psyche. Women are having to integrate with a group of men that are the most inclined, probably, to associate a woman with irresponsibility and incompetence. Statements like, what are you, some kind of girl or sissy, I think indicate that. And second, not being allowed in the most dangerous area of combat does discriminate against a certain percentage of women who want to enter those areas.
And the discrimination against men?
By not allowing women into the most dangerous combat positions, all of the most dangerous positions, like cannon artillery specialists and infantry positions and armored tank specialists, all of those positions need to be filled by men, when in fact these are the least desired positions in the armed services. That is, as you probably know, the services are often called the College for the Poor, preparing people who are poor for civilian life. But there are few jobs in civilian life that are called cannon artillery specialists.
Yeah.
And there's few help wanted ads saying infantry experience and post-traumatic stress required. So 100% of these positions that are the least useful in civilian life are filled by men, while approximately 250,000 jobs that train men for civilian life have been lost by men to women. Jobs like computer specialties, flight controller, jet mechanic, nursing, teaching, etc. This all leaves a higher percentage of women who re-enter civilian life prepared for a constructive life, while at the same time it leaves a higher percentage of men prepared for useless and destructive lives.
Okay, so I guess what you're saying is that women get a better chance for certain kinds of training that are more constructive. But during the war in the Persian Gulf, didn't Congresswoman Schroeder often say that women shared equal combat risks without equal combat pay?
Yes, not only did she say that, but the popular media also bought that line and the corollary assumptions that women were being denied combat positions in order to deny them equal opportunity as officers.
Well, you're implying that there are three myths here, the myth of equal risks, as well as the myths of unequal opportunity as officers and unequal pay.
Exactly. Let me take the equal risks first. In Panama and the Persian Gulf operations combined, 27 men died for each woman. So women are still not sharing equal risks to men. And even when you calculate that there are 9 men in the armed services for each woman, any given man's risk when he enters the armed services is still 3 times as great as women's of being killed. This difference is a result of women being placed in zones of indirect combat when they choose to enter combat, and men being placed in the zones of direct combat.
And the myth of unequal opportunity as officers?
Women constitute 11.7% of the total military, but 12% of the officers, despite the fact that the first females graduated from West Point only in 1980.
So they have not been in the military nearly as long as some men who are not getting promoted. Amazing. What a contrast to the image the media gives us. And the myth of unequal pay?
Although the women were only in the less dangerous combat zones, both sexes in the Persian Gulf received $110 per month extra combat pay. Women received equal pay for unequal risk.
You're saying that in times of war, a man entering the armed services is required to enter any combat position as needed, while women are given the option to enter or not enter combat, and that this is part of an underlying discrimination of giving women options and men obligations?
Yes. What we're doing is we're creating two different armies, his army versus her army. His army is an army of obligations. Her army is an army of rights. And this is the basis, I think, for enormous misunderstandings in the armed services. For example, combat training requires men to devalue their lives. However, training for technical jobs that can be used in civilian life is compatible with valuing one's life. So when a man enters the armed services, hazing and harassment are preparation for his role of being devalued.
Ah.
That's why men have historically hazed and harassed each other. They're amputating each other's individuality because the war machine works best with standardized parts.
Are you suggesting here that women object to harassment and hazing because they're trained to see the armed services as an opportunity compatible with valuing their life, while harassment and hazing are only compatible with devaluing life?
Exactly.
Is there a solution to all this?
Well, the abbreviated solution, the only one I have time for here, is making a decision of what type of army we want and then giving both sexes equal opportunity and equal obligation.
You mentioned that mail-only draft registration and combat requirements are the two most unconstitutional laws in America. But since we're not in a war situation, what are the practical effects of women not having to register for the draft?
It's creating a moral dilemma for boys that we don't create for girls. Every 18-year-old boy has to face a moral dilemma from which every woman is free. He has to face the fact that if he doesn't sign up for the draft, he can never work at a government job or even get a government loan for a private school, to say nothing of facing up to 5 years in prison and $250,000 fine. He may be able to break the law by not signing up and get away with it, but that decision is the end of his innocence. All of this is part of the psychological preparation for preparing a boy for war. And then, once the country goes to war, we talk about the importance of not bombing innocent women and children. So what we do is allow women to escape responsibility and then calling them innocent for that escape.
Wow.
In a country in which both sexes vote, when that country goes to war, all of its adult citizens are equally innocent and equally guilty.
What about people who say war is caused by men?
War is caused by our primal fear of not surviving. That's a two-sex fear. Even in the war in the Persian Gulf, when the U.S. attacked Iraq, more than three-quarters of women approved, as did 87% of men.
Concerning the innocence you've been talking about, I was fascinated by your connection of female innocence to your belief that men love women more than they love themselves, but that they respect themselves more than they respect women. Would you explain that to me?
Yes. We love what's innocent, which is why we're willing to kiss infants and kiss even puppy dogs, but we respect what protects us. However, the shadow side of protecting is constant exposure to the ugly that destroys the innocent. And as we expose ourselves to the ugly, we tend to lose our own innocence. So when a man falls in love with an innocent woman, he, quote, falls in love because her innocence allows him to have a reunion with a part of himself that got lost in the process of protecting her innocence.
Ah.
He wants to see his innocent self because that allows him to see his soul directly, the way we see mountains in a land that has no smog.
What with men cutting themselves off from their feelings and adopting mottos like when the going gets tough, the tough get going, how is all that compatible with men being what you call the suicide sex?
I think there's no greater proof of the underlying need of both sexes for love than the proof that comes with understanding that even when that sex, men, cut themselves off from feelings and are deprived of love, how men then, when deprived of love, commit suicide. For example, when a husband whose wife dies is about 10 times more likely to commit suicide than a wife whose husband dies, you can get some understanding of the feeling that we don't see beneath men.
Are you saying that what's behind men committing suicide four times as often as women is they're not feeling loved?
Basically, yes. People who feel genuinely loved and needed rarely commit suicide, either women or men. But for a lot of different reasons, women are more likely to feel loved and needed. For example, when a woman and man divorces, and so therefore they're both deprived enormously of feeling loved and needed, she, though, usually has physical custody over the children about 90% of the time. She's more likely to feel loved and needed. She may also feel more stressed out, but feeling stressed out while feeling loved and needed does not lead to suicide.
Divorce is more likely to disconnect a man from love?
Yes. Men, when they're divorced, often feel needed as a wallet, but a very high percentage of men feel their children have been turned against them after divorce, and that they're obligated to pay money to a woman who hates him and to children who don't seem to love him. Now, if he has that situation, and he also makes an attempt to get shared custody of the children, and he's falsely accused of sexual abuse, we often have a suicide waiting to happen. We have a man, which means the sex most poorly socialized to create a support system, not only having his support system wiped out, but having much of the community turned against him in cases of accusations of sexual abuse. He is made to feel not only worthless, but evil.
Warren, you often say that men feel they will not be loved unless they have money.
Yes. A warm and tender and sensitive man who's reading I'm okay, you're okay in the unemployment line is rarely invited home to dinner by a woman.
I'm afraid that's probably true. But would it follow that unemployed men, particularly men who have just been fired or involuntarily lost their job, that they would feel the fear of being unloved and unneeded and therefore more likely to commit suicide?
Yes. In the middle of the Great Depression, for example, men were 650% more likely to commit suicide than women. Even today, unemployed men commit suicide at twice the rate of employed men.
Well, what about unemployed women?
Among women, there's no difference in the rate of suicide based on whether or not the woman is employed.
Women do not feel more or less loved based on whether or not they're employed.
Not significantly enough so to commit suicide over it. And they also have better support systems to work from.
You know, I've heard that the adolescent suicide rate has been going up.
It has. But it's interesting, what we haven't heard about is the fact that the suicide rate of adolescent boys has recently increased 3 times as quickly as the girls. And among young women, young women's rates have decreased, while young men's rates have increased.
So your implication here is that when boys' rates increase more, we just hear about the rise in adolescent rates, not boys' rates. And when young women's rates decrease, while young men's increase, we don't hear anything?
Exactly.
I think the most astonishing figure you mentioned in the suicide chapter is that boys' suicide increases 25,000% as their sex roles become apparent. Now, that's incredible. Why do you think that's occurring?
I think partially because we're giving girls more options. When I say more options, what I basically mean is that the girl, therefore, has more ways of getting approval during the years when, as we all know, if you don't get approval, it feels like death. Meantime, we still tell boys to play the same old role, perform, pursue, pay, what I call the 3 P's.
So teenage boys' greater socialization to perform is what leads to their greater suicide.
Almost. It's the demand to perform without the resources to perform, and the constant experience of rejection to an already insecure identity that is being further battered by the commerce of male adolescence, meaning the commerce of wit-covered put-downs that all of us who have had adolescence know what I mean.
So it ends up being only the football players that receive something close to unconditional approval.
Yes, and it's sort of ironic that the biggest, quote, winners, the football players, are receiving love via self-abuse. For some boys, receiving love via self-abuse creates a bit of anxiety. But losing love creates even more anxiety. So these boys are caught between the anxiety of abuse by other boys and the anxiety of rejection by girls.
Okay, but wait a minute. Is female depression the equivalent of male suicide?
No, that's a big myth. Reporting depression empowers women. Suicide does not empower men. It empowers women, reporting depression does, because it allows women to get help. Suicide leaves everyone helpless. Reporting depression is really part of the solution.
You know, when we think of depression, Warren, we tend to think of middle-class women, not poor women. Why is that?
It's because depression is a diagnosis that tends to increase among people with the luxury of being able to worry about something other than survival. It's often a middle-class woman who's married to a man who's successful enough to pay for a psychiatrist to diagnose her as depressed. Few women who are poor have this luxury.
Now, you've said that the bottom line of power is the length of life. Tell me about that.
The length of life is, in essence, the best summary of the accumulation of our life's stresses subtracted from our life's rewards.
Isn't part of the difference in life expectancy biological?
If much of the difference were biological, American men would not have died just 1 year sooner than women in 1920, but 7 years sooner today. That's an extraordinary difference, but to me, I think what's even more extraordinary is the fact that we don't even know that. Or, I guess more accurately, that we don't care to know it, since this has basically been true for a couple of decades now, and the data has been available to us all along. We have just cared not to look at it.
I wonder what our reaction would be if it was the opposite. But what accounts for this difference, do you think?
When women and men have an approximately equal life expectancy, it's usually when they're equally subject to contagious parasitic diseases and to poor sanitation. And it's in places where female deaths in childbirth are similar to the numbers of male deaths in war. However, in more industrialized societies, all the problems that affect male and female life expectancy about equally, or the problems that affect women more, like childbirth, have been enormously reduced. So almost all our problems today with diseases seem to come from immune system breakdowns, which comes predominantly from stress. And that triggers whatever biological weaknesses are part of that person's heritage, like heart attacks, cancer, diabetes, etc. It is since stress has become the key factor that men have died so much sooner than women.
But we hear more about the stress women endure in their multiple roles. We hear about the superwoman syndrome and the female juggling act.
Yes, I think these are legitimate and they're accurate stresses that a lot of women do experience. But the multiple options that women who are married to successful men have allows the women to tailor their roles to their personalities, whereas the male mandate to work full-time, that mandate does not allow him flexibility. It's a straitjacket. He can't work in a way that suits his personality or be with children in a way that suits his personality.
So industrialization has broadened women's options and deepened men's mold?
Exactly. As I mentioned at the beginning of the tape, men's role in industrialized society has taken them away from home and away from love. And also, men's role has done a lot more to produce better homes and gardens for women than it's done to produce safer coal mines and construction sites for men. So we're still in an era where men's disconnection from love, away in the workplace, pays women to love. Their money pays women to love, whereas no one pays men to love.
You know, we often hear that medical research neglects women, that less money and attention are given to female health than male health. What do you think about that?
It's not true. No governmental agency focusing on health spends as much on men's health as on women's health.
Well, I've read that only 10% of the National Institute of Health, the NIH's budget, is spent on women's health.
But can I bet you that you haven't read that only 5% of the NIH budget is spent on men's health?
You're right. I hadn't. So that's what we're not told?
Correct. What you're also not told is that the other 85% is on non-gender-specific health issues, basic science.
What about more studies being done on men than on women?
When we search the 3,000 medical journals that are listed in Index Medicus, 23 articles are written on women's health for each one written on men's health.
What about what we've heard about heart disease studies being done on men but not on women, such as the study that related to the effects of aspirin on heart attacks done only on male physicians?
It's interesting. The whole nation heard of that study, but no one heard that there was a simultaneous study done on the effect of aspirins on heart attacks done only on female nurses, in which four times as many women were studied as in the male study.
Aren't there many other studies done only on groups of men?
Yes. A high percentage of those studies, though, have been experimentation studies. Studies, for example, done of potentially dangerous drugs that were done on all male prisoners or on military men. Studies on LSD, on sulfa drugs, things like that. The reason we do more research on men in prison and men in the military and on men in general than we do on women is the same reason we do more research on rats than we do on humans.
Wow. But isn't there neglect of certain areas of female health, like breast cancer?
Personally, I think all health research is neglected compared to other priorities. But we have to remember that men are almost as likely to die from prostate cancer as women are from breast cancer. Yet our funding for breast cancer is 660% greater than our funding for prostate cancer research. If it was the other way around, I would be protesting the sexism against women.
Now, what about the neglect for women's health issues such as ovarian cancer and menopause?
Fortunately, the neglect is now being remedied by the new Office of Research on Women's Health, but there's no Office of Research on Men's Health addressing any of the 17 areas of men's health that are now being neglected.
17? Some examples.
Testicular cancer, nonspecific urethritis, the development of a men's birth control pill, looking at the issues that create and could prevent male suicide, post-traumatic stress syndrome, circumcision as a possible trauma-producing experience, dyslexia, the underlying causes of male violence, the factors that lead to men being 85% of the homeless, rehabilitation methods to prevent recidivism of the 94% of prisoners who are men, sexual impotence, colorblindness, steroid abuse, so on.
Can I get back to the heart attacks for a moment? Isn't it true that women dying now of heart attacks, that that's occurring at the same rate as men?
It's interesting. We've all heard that, and technically speaking, that's true. But what very few of us have heard is that almost three-quarters of women who die of heart attacks are 75 years old or older. By that time, the average man has already been dead for 3 years.
Now, I've also heard that men with heart attack symptoms are more likely to receive the most advanced and effective operations. Is that true?
Yes, that's true. But what we don't hear is the reason. The woman is much more likely to have her heart attack symptoms when she's much older. Therefore, she's likely to have a lot of other complications as well. Therefore, surgery is more likely to end her life because of the other complications.
Surgery is much more dangerous for somebody who's that much older.
Exactly. And what we're not told is that the 50-year-old man who has his heart attack symptoms is much less likely to have those other complications, therefore he's more likely to be able to risk surgery. So in brief, when age and other complicating factors are controlled for, studies show that there's no difference between the treatment of men versus the treatment of women with heart attacks.
You know, given all this, it sounds like what you're saying is that the real sexism is in the concern that we've expressed for women versus the lack of concern that we express for men.
Exactly. And the sad thing, though, is that when one sex loses, both sexes lose. A woman who loses her husband, her dad, or her son also loses. Or put another way, when just one sex appears to win, both sexes lose.
You mentioned in your chapter on the insanity track, which deals with men at the top, that these men are not really powerful because power is control over one's own life, and that these men at the top often lose control over their life. Do you feel this is true even of people like lawyers and doctors?
Yes, I think it is. The alcoholism rate among lawyers is about twice as high as it is among the general population. 41% of lawyers would enter another profession if they had to do it all over again. Among doctors, first-year residents in pediatrics and obstetrics average 90 hours per week. And one additional point, 1 in 10 surgical residents exceed 122 hours per week.
What happens when men just say no to providing this financial womb, as you call it?
And just say no, as in Nancy Reagan. When men just say no, so to speak, they become invisible, especially, unfortunately, to women. Or they become ostracized, often by both sexes. For example, black men are often the subject of ridicule by black women and have been for many years. American Indian men or Native American men were admired until they no longer protected women effectively, and then they were confined to the reservations of their defeat. And gay men, the men who wouldn't protect women, have been ostracized by both sexes in almost all cultures.
And as you've pointed out before, unemployed and homeless men are not being sought out by the Marla Maples of the world.
Right.
It would follow from what you've been saying that we would be far more concerned with women as victims of violence than we would be with men as victims of violence. Is that true?
Yes, it is true. For every woman who is murdered, three men are murdered. With the exception of rape, the more violent the crime, the more likely the victim is to be a man. Forcible rape constitutes less than 4% of all violent crimes. Violent crime of which men are the victims constitute 94%.
Of course, men do commit most of the violent crime.
Yes, it's interesting that when we hear that blacks are the greater victims of violent crimes, we would consider it racist to say, well, blacks commit most of the violent crime against blacks, so therefore, the victim is a victim, no matter who the perpetrator was.
Are we less sympathetic towards men because we think of violence as being a reflection of male power?
Yes, I think that is the reason that we are less sympathetic. But I also would like to challenge that reason as being inaccurate. Violence is almost always the outgrowth of powerlessness, not power. Be it black powerlessness or male powerlessness.
Tell me about that.
My first education on this issue came in the mid-80s when Flint, Michigan, at that time was a town with a very low rate of rape, murder, and spouse abuse. And then, as you probably remember, the 30,000 auto workers were either unemployed or dislodged from their jobs when the General Motors plants shut down.
Uh-huh.
And Flint, Michigan, within a year or two, soon had a higher rate of violent crime than New York City. It reported 285 rapes in 1985 alone, which was a staggering figure for a city of 150,000 people. In brief, people become violent and criminals when there's a gap between their expectation to provide and their ability to provide. When they experience powerlessness, they become criminals, not power.
You know, Warren, after hearing all this, there's one question that really troubles me. Why is it that all of us, both males and females, seem to be so resistant to hearing and to understanding how men are hurt?
Historically, woman as victim attracts men. Man as victim repulses woman.
Oh, yeah.
Almost every day we see this acted out. When you see a woman's tire go flat, for example,
uh-huh.
She will suddenly allow a strange man off the highway an opportunity to help her. But if a man's tire goes flat, she rarely stops to help the man, despite the fact that when his tire goes flat, she has much more of an opportunity to look him over first. Historically, women dropped handkerchiefs, that is, they played victims. And when they dropped the handkerchief, this was a way of discovering where the saviors were located. When men dropped handkerchiefs, we picked them up. And we see the result of this sort of repulsion toward men as victim everywhere. Corporal punishment is still legal in 29 states, but practically speaking, corporal punishment is boy punishment. The same type of thing with capital punishment. Practically speaking, it is male-only punishment. We consider it racist to hit black boys more than white boys, but no school protests the propensity to hit only boys.
Okay, let's look at this point. Feminists have objected to violence against women on TV and in films. Is that a valid issue?
I think we're definitely a society that's addicted to violence, but I'd like to confront our violence toward both sexes. In fact, of people who are killed on TV entertainment programs, about 97% are men. In the movies, it's about 95% men. Six of our most popular film types are men-die films. Westerns are men killing men. War movies are men killing men. Murder mysteries are men killing men. Women in Jeopardy films are mostly men killing men. Mob films are men killing men. Gang films, the same thing. We repeatedly pay to watch the murder of men by men.
Why does it seem like there's a higher percentage of women dying?
Because we care so much more when a woman dies, or even when she's hurt. Which is why entire films focus on the woman in jeopardy. It makes us care. But almost always in a Woman in Jeopardy film, the woman is saved, in fact, while many men usually die saving her. Our concern is for the woman, but the sacrifice is of the man. A man who puts a woman in jeopardy is unforgiven, which is, of course, what was unforgiven in the film Unforgiven. One woman was hurt in that film, and about a dozen men were killed in the process of teaching a couple of men that they'd better not even hurt a woman. Notice I said, by the way, about a dozen men. I don't even know if it was exactly a dozen. The men who died were actually less visible than the one woman who was hurt.
Part 3 of the myth of male power, perhaps the most powerful and shocking section of the book. It's called The Government as Substitute Husband. You have chapter titles in that part such as Women Who Kill Too Much and The Courts That Free Them, which sounded more like a spoof until I started reading about the 12 different female defenses, such as the battered woman syndrome, that allow a woman to kill a man and get a reduced sentence or go free on probation, without a man in a parallel situation having that option. Would you start out by explaining what you mean by the government as substitute husband?
Yes, okay. When divorce has left women without a husband as savior, many women started to look for substitute saviors. The poor woman looked to AFDC payments, for example.
Aids to families with dependent children.
Exactly. If the government paid more than the man could, she in essence would choose the government over the man, in a sense marry the government. This was especially reinforced by the fact that the government would only give AFDC payments to her if the man wasn't around.
Would it give AFDC payments to the man if the woman wasn't around and the man took care of the children?
Basically, no. The requirements for a man to get AFDC payments were much tougher, virtually impossible, which is, of course, unconstitutional, but yet it exists. The government did not play substitute wife, either by providing the man domestic services or by providing the man income.
But you're saying that in the past years, since the rise of the feminist movement, the government has played substitute husband to more middle-class women as well.
Yes. Programs, for example, like WIC, which is a Women, Infants, and Children program, these were increasingly developed for women, for infants, for children, but not for men, infants, and children. And as women entered the workplace, the government passed more laws to protect women from dirty jokes than to protect men from death via faulty rafters at construction sites.
It's funny. The more things change.
Yes, and you see this even among New Age women and men. New Age women often went from father to husband to guru. And men, we competed to be their guru. In the name of enlightenment, neither sex was fundamentally changing their fundamental role. What had been true among traditional women and men, for example, going from father to husband to God the Father, and men competing to be their fathers in the form of either priests or ministers or rabbis, really wasn't that much different than it was among New Age women and men.
I assume you would acknowledge that men make the laws, but it sounds like you're saying that although laws were made almost always by men, they're not made for men, at least when it came to male-female issues.
Correct. At least that can be said unequivocally prior to women having the vote. In the 1992 presidential election, 54% of the voters were female, 46% were male. Women's votes outnumbered men's by more than 7 million.
Your point being that the voter is in control?
Basically, the legislator is like a chauffeur, and the voter is like the owner of the limo. The voter, or the owner of the limo, tells the chauffeur where to go, so to speak. And it's the chauffeur's job to choose how to get the owner there. The ultimate power is in the owner or the voter, who can fire the chauffeur as soon as the contract is up if she or he does not do a good job getting us where we tell him or her to go.
Well, what about the fact that so many legislators are men?
The sex of the legislator is less important than the sex of the voter.
Ah.
Ultimately, the voter owns the legislator. The legislator is the servant, the chauffeur. Men are often better protectors of women than women are. Both sexes vote for protectors of females. Anytime women want more women, or even all women, to be legislators, that's exactly what would happen. Women have 54% of the vote.
You say that the system protects women on every level more than it does men, even female criminals. Can you explain?
A man convicted of murder is 20 times more likely than a woman convicted of murder to receive the death penalty. Since 1954, approximately 70,000 women have murdered about 60,000 men. But not one woman has been executed for only killing a man.
So the death penalty is a male-only penalty?
Not quite. Women receive the death penalty a small percentage of the time, but only men actually get executed.
Ah.
There's only been basically one exception to that since 1976, at the point when the death penalty was reinstated.
Uh-huh.
And that was the execution of a woman who said she preferred to be executed and who killed, of course,
a woman.
Exactly.
Well, is there sex discrimination in sentencing for other crimes?
Yes. Being male contributes to a longer sentence more than race does or any other factor, either legal or extra-legal. Ironically, sentencing guidelines were introduced to eliminate racial discrimination, not sex discrimination. Although there's about a 70% addition for being male for crimes like burglary or larceny, even when the history of those crimes are relatively equal, the initial sex discrimination occurs prior even to the trial.
Prior to the trial?
Yes. For example, if a couple is a partner in committing a crime, prosecutors will almost always give the woman the first option to have the charges against her dropped in exchange for helping them get evidence against the man. So he ends up with a prison record, she doesn't. Then, of course, if they both commit another crime, he can, quote, legitimately receive a longer sentence. He had a worse criminal history.
How is this rationalized? After all, you pointed out that the 14th Amendment guarantees that there not be discrimination according to sex, that both sexes receive equal protection under the law.
It's rationalized, for example, by saying that the woman was brainwashed by the man. However, even when a woman is in charge, men still do more time. For example, in the McMartin preschool case, Peggy McMartin was the school's director, and she hired her 19-year-old grandson. Although both were indicted on 52 counts of child molestation, and both were eventually to be found not guilty, she, the director, spent less than 2 years in jail, while he spent nearly 5 years in jail.
Well, how is it that they spent all this time in jail, even though they were found not guilty?
They were awaiting trial, and it became the longest trial in U.S. criminal history. What my question is would we have tolerated the longest trial in U.S. criminal history while a granddaughter, eventually found not guilty, nevertheless spent half her 20s in prison for allegedly touching children?
I don't think so. Is this tendency to be protective of women versus men true even among boys versus girls when we're talking about children?
Yes. For example, when two teenagers, Marjorie Filipiak and Keith Wilkins, both pled guilty to being co-conspirators in a murder, and neither was a hardened criminal, Keith Wilkins got the death sentence and Marjorie Filipiak went free.
Why is that?
Almost always when a girl is a criminal, we look for a way to blame the parents or the girl's background. But when Keith Wilkins, for example, was found to be a victim of child sexual abuse, it didn't deter the judge from giving him the death sentence.
And as I recall, Keith Wilkins was just 16 years old. We hear a lot about the poor prison conditions that women have to endure.
In fact, while a lot can validly be said about the poverty of prison conditions, female prisoners, relative to men, are in prison situations which are far more rehabilitative. There's more money per female prisoner. And any given man in prison is still 1,000% as likely as any given woman to die via suicide, homicide, or execution.
To say nothing of the rape in men's prisons.
Yes.
With all that you're saying, how is it that some of the commissions on gender bias have reported that it is women who are the victims of discrimination?
They do it by saying things like, quote, women receive longer periods of probation, which is true, because women go free on probation while men get the prison sentences.
Aren't these government commissions?
They are government commissions only in the sense that they're paid for by the government, meaning us, but the commissions were formed as an outgrowth of the Feminist National Organization for Women and the Mostly Feminist National Association of Women Judges. Of course, to have a feminist government commission investigating sex role discrimination is like having a Republican government commission investigating political party bias. If a political party did this, we'd call it a scandal. When feminists do this, it's called official. Feminism has, in a sense, become gender politics' one-party system.
Amazing. You know, you mention a lot of other discriminations in the myth of male power, like the fact that we tell women they have the right to children, but tell men they have to fight for children. But maybe one of the most interesting ones was this whole double standard of community property.
Yes, do you remember Jim and Tammy Faye Baker?
How could anybody forget?
They both had equal rights to profits in their business, no matter what role Tammy played. But when the business got into trouble, Jim got 40 years in prison and Tammy Faye got...
none.
Exactly. Tammy Faye didn't even have to appear in court. On the surface, this appears justifiable if Tammy didn't know what was going on. But if equality means a woman shares legal rights to the profits of a marriage, no matter what role she plays, and even if she didn't know what was going on, or no matter how illegally those profits were accrued, then equality also means a woman shares legal responsibility for any illegalities in creating those profits, no matter what role she plays. If community property is couple profit, regardless of role, it must become couple responsibility, regardless of role.
Any exceptions to this rule?
Yes, if the man systematically falsifies information despite his wife's questioning. but we cannot make a full partner innocent because of ignorance. No one would suggest making only the mother financially responsible for the damage caused by a child, quote, since the father was ignorant of what was going on. We would say that the father's lack of awareness was part of what created the delinquency. An unaware father is considered negligent, not innocent. Allowing women to receive the upside of profits but to avoid the downside of prison encourages women to assign their husbands all the financial risks. It reinforces female as child, and it gives her an incentive to avoid financial sophistication and therefore leads to her financial dependency. And for that reason, in the final analysis, community property without community responsibility is really discrimination against women.
Discrimination against women?
By keeping her financially dependent.
Ah. Well, let's move now to the chapter I was mentioning before on the 12 female-only defenses called Women Who Kill Too Much and the Courts That Free Them.
Yes, and of course, neither women nor men are exempt from killing loved ones. I want to make that clear at the outset. The difference is what happens to them when they do. In all these 12 defenses I'll be talking about, a woman who commits a premeditated murder can have charges dropped or significantly reduced. No man has successfully ever been able to use any of these defenses to successfully do the same, and there are no parallel male-only defenses. Therefore, each of these defenses violates the 14th Amendment, and the combination creates a female standard of self-defense versus a male standard, which I believe will wreak havoc in the legal system for decades and be affecting for a lifetime our children's fear of commitment, especially our son's fear of commitment.
I'd like to get an overview of these 12 defenses. You call one of them the innocent woman defense. Tell me more about that.
An example of the innocent woman defense comes with a woman named Blanche Taylor Moore. First she killed her husband with arsenic, then she killed a boyfriend, her father, then she attempted to kill her second husband before the police even became suspicious. Now this all happened in one very small community. It was the assumption of her innocence that allowed her to escape from serious questioning for a quarter of a century.
Assumption automatic because she was a woman.
Uh-huh. The underlying problem with the assumption of innocence is the frequency with which the woman kills again. It's ironic that we live in an era in which the release of Willie Horton was enough to ruin a presidential candidate, even as we, quote, release female Willie Hortons by not questioning them.
Okay, tell me about what you call the PMS defense.
The PMS defense freed Christine English after she confessed to killing her boyfriend by deliberately ramming him into a utility pole with a car.
Ouch.
This has led to other hormonal defenses, such as, near my hometown in San Diego, a woman named Sherilyn Massip placing her six-month-old son under her car, running over him repeatedly, and then, uncertain he was dead, doing it again, then claiming postpartum depression. Her sentence? Outpatient help. No feminists protested. The PMS defense and other hormonal defenses really bother me because they are superficial protection for women that leads to long-term discrimination against women.
Tell me about that.
For example, if a woman can murder while she's under the influence of PMS, she can clearly be a reckless driver when she's under the influence of PMS. And if she doesn't know when she's under the influence, this becomes a reason not to let women drive. We're back to women as children.
What would be the male equivalent of a PMS defense?
Oh my God, probably a TP defense, like a testosterone poisoning hormonal defense.
Okay.
And you could imagine where we're going to go with that one. Of course there is none, and there better never be one, but the same logic that says women can murder and claim PMS would say men can rape and claim testosterone poisoning.
Ah, of course.
I didn't think I'd ever live in a society where either would be justifiable.
Well, in some ways, one of the most amazing defenses is one of the ones, the next one, it's called the learned helplessness defense, or the battered woman syndrome.
Yes, until 1982, almost anyone who called a premeditated murder self-defense would have been laughed out of court. But when in 1990, the governor of Ohio released from prison 25 women who had been convicted of killing or severely assaulting their husbands, Ohio became the 15th state to allow women who murder their husbands to possibly get away with it by claiming past abuse. Notice I said claiming because their husbands were not in the position, being dead, to argue the claim.
What's the main problem you have with this battered woman or learned helplessness defense?
First, any defense must apply to both sexes whenever it is applicable. There are tens of thousands of men who also experience learned helplessness, but who are without a learned helplessness defense.
And you mentioned in your book the astounding fact that the sexes batter each other about equally?
Yes. This is one of the most amazing secrets of the last 20 years. Every study that has ever examined spouse abuse by asking both sexes how often they were abused, not just women, has found that approximately equal numbers of men are abused by their wives as vice versa. Because it doesn't hurt a man as much to be hit by a woman is more likely to resort to more severe physical violence, like throwing boiling water over the man or slamming him with a frying pan. But I don't want to get sidetracked here on the studies that prove equality of battering. Even if only 5% of the abuse was female to male, and even if it was only elderly men who couldn't escape their female caretakers who experienced battered man syndrome, it would be unconstitutional not to have a learned helplessness defense for men when we have one for women.
Feminists complain that women are more afraid than men to report their abusers to the authorities.
Actually, the opposite is true. Despite the 14 separate studies that I just referred to that are two-sex studies, finding that women and men are equally as likely to batter, more than 90% of the reports are made by women, which is why we think that women are the predominantly battered sex. Women, then, are about 9 times as likely as men to report their abusers to authorities. Male socialization, part of male socialization is to, quote, take it like a man. And that take it like a man is the male version of learned helplessness. Women's strength is their facade of weakness. Men's weakness is their facade of strength.
It's amazing how much of this we never think about and never see. Warren, can we switch now from death to sex?
Gladly.
The first thing you deal with in the Politics of Sex chapter is why sexual harassment is such a big issue for women. Tell me about that.
Yeah, a lot of women say that men don't get it when it comes to sexual harassment, and actually they're right. And the reason is this. When a woman is growing up, her early years are always, she's focused on and gets a lot of her attention because of her attractiveness or lack of attractiveness.
Hmm.
And then she enters a workplace, and if she's very attractive and she's getting her attention because of a lot of attractiveness issues, she starts beginning to think to herself, am I valued as a worker? Now, a man, when he's growing up, a boy, when he's growing up, he gets his attention based on things like performance. When he gets into the workplace, he's still being evaluated based on performance. So the workplace is a fairly easy extension of adolescence for a boy. It is not an easy extension of adolescence for a girl. So the best way that I can help a man understand this is imagine, guys, if you were growing up always getting compliments on your mechanical ability.
Okay.
And now suddenly you're being evaluated by a social worker to see whether you're a good parent. And the social worker is constantly complimenting you on how the grease under your fingernails really turns her on because it reminds her of what a great mechanic you are. And you realize you're going to lose custody over your child if she isn't focusing on you as a good parent. That's the equivalent of the woman's fear that she's going to lose the ability to get a good promotion because the man's always focused on her sexually when she wants to be evaluated based on her work competence.
Yet, doesn't the current approach to sexual harassment seem to so many men to be unfair?
Yes, because men see something else happening at the workplace. Approximately 2/3 of women who enter the workplace when they're single and who get married a man that they met at the workplace or through a workplace contact.
Uh-huh.
Now, most of the men that they ended up marrying were men who were above them at work, number one, and number two, men who took the sexual initiative. Now, this is also the definition of sexual harassment. A man above you at work takes the sexual initiative. It can be one of two things. It can be a future potential candidate for marriage
or a
husband, or a future potential candidate for a lawsuit. It could be a future husband or a future harasser. And so men feel like, you know, when this situation works for the woman, they call it courtship. When it doesn't work, they call it harassment. You know, what is this? But no one is saying, okay, the woman will take over the responsibility and she'll ask me out. I'm still expected socially to take the sexual initiative, and if I don't, I'll be watching all the guys around me who do that walk this thin line between a courtship possibility and an harassment lawsuit. So he's sort of saying to himself, when it works, it's called marriage with a woman's picture in the paper. When it doesn't work, it's called a lawsuit and my picture's in the paper.
Couldn't men be overstating this, though? I mean, isn't it really just harassment only when he persists?
Legally, actually not. And here's the reason. I could ask a woman who's working for me out, and it's absolutely true that just one asking of her out could make her feel very awkward and uncomfortable by having to say no to me. And in the future, because I've made a work experience into a social experience and she's rejected me, she feels like she's in a hostile work environment. She's fearing that I will be negative to her. And so it's legitimate that the woman can feel like she's in a hostile work environment after I have socially initiated. But the solution to that is not what she is legally allowed to do, which is to make that into a lawsuit, because right now a lawsuit can be upheld merely when the woman feels like the environment is hostile and it's reasonable that she feels that way.
In practical terms, though, aren't most lawsuits against men who simply wouldn't take no for an answer?
I think practically speaking, that's probably true. And yet when we hear about the experiences of exceptions to that, it makes almost every man just not know where the boundaries are with any given woman. And it's also true that many women acknowledge eventually marrying men to whom they had at first said no, that is, men who had in fact persisted. By today's standards, these women are married to people who are legitimate sexual harassers, or quote legitimate sexual harassers. But a lot of these women say that they're glad the man persisted. They're married to these men.
So men are going to feel confused.
Other men, not you and I.
Oh, of course, you're right.
I think what makes a lot of men confused is that they see women taking indirect initiatives, and they're quite sure that they are indirect initiatives, but they know that if they respond to them, that they're the ones that could be held vulnerable. And they get this idea reinforced when they see women reading things like Cosmopolitan magazine, and the article is telling the women things like this, and I'm actually quoting from Cosmo, quote, "As you pass his desk, drop a pile of papers or a purse. Then stoop down to gather them up. He'll pick it up. Lean close to him. Put your hand on his shoulder to steady your balance." Another example is, if you're interested in him, just pick off a little bit of lint from his jacket. Make personal contact. Or brush up against him in the elevator. Or wear a very tight short skirt. And bend over with your back to him to pick up something or to look in a file drawer. And the problem with that is if the man responds to a woman who's just picked off some lint off of his jacket and they're in court and the judge says, well, why did you start initiating with her? And he says, well, Your Honor, she initiated. She picked lint off of my jacket. He's not on very strong ground.
Well, in other words, with this example of the things that women get from magazines like Cosmopolitan, women are being taught to take indirect initiatives to start relationships.
Yes, and indirect initiatives have historically worked, and they still do. But the problem is that sometimes the wrong man approaches the woman who's leaned over the file drawer in her tight short skirt, and when he approaches her, her discomfort may make it feel like a hostile environment to her, legitimately so. And thus he becomes vulnerable to a lawsuit.
Because in her mind, he was the wrong man, not the one that she wanted. Well, is there something deeper going on here?
Yes, there is. But first of all, I want to make it clear that a lot of sexual harassment lawsuits are legitimate. And at the same time, it's also true that something deeper is going on here. What we may be having in sexual harassment lawsuits is just a further updated version of the female selection process of making it hard for men to go through hoops to see which men are willing to take risks. And because with birth control we were able to minimize the amount of risks that needed to be taken by men toward women, these sexual harassment lawsuits and the date rape legislation are all ways of seeing whether men can jump through new hoops without getting caught and without stumbling.
This time risking their careers.
Correct. Historically speaking, one of the reasons that women said no was that they found out which men were interested enough to keep pursuing them and which men got past their no's with finesse. That was a woman's way of testing which were the men who could overcome life's barriers. If he could overcome life's barriers, he was going to be a good breadwinner. If he was a salesperson, and the first time he got no for an answer, he said, oh, okay, you don't want the product, no problem, goodbye. She knew she didn't have a breadwinner on her hand.
So what's your underlying objection to sexual harassment legislation in its present form?
I believe that we need to be re-socializing both sexes simultaneously, not just blaming men. We need to be encouraging women to do their own initiatives and risk rejection. At the same time, we need to start saying to men, when a woman says no, stop. Make the woman take responsibility for the consequences of her no. Don't keep telling her, in essence, when you say no, I'll keep trying harder. We need to encourage both sexes to take different types of sexual responsibility than we've been trained to take in the past.
Do you think there are other areas of misunderstanding around this whole issue?
Maybe 100 or so.
Okay.
I think two of the ones that are really important are dirty jokes have often been gotten onto lately, and the whole hazing issue.
Okay.
We're often told that dirty jokes are the male method of intimidating women.
Uh-huh.
In fact, men tell dirty jokes to peers, to bond to peers, not to intimidate peers.
Tell me about that.
When a boss tells a dirty joke, it's often his unconscious way of getting his staff to not take him so seriously and therefore not be intimidated.
Ah. Well, what about hazing?
Hazing has a fascinating background. Men haze each other as an unconscious way of teaching others to survive attacks to their vulnerable areas. That's what, when you see adolescent boys put each other down and haze each other, that's what they've been training themselves to do, to handle attacks without being defeated by those attacks. So a short guy, for example, will be a victim of jokes like, "Hey, which is higher, your IQ or your size?" And historically, men knew that if a man was preoccupied with his vulnerability, he was not able to be a protector, because he'd be preoccupied with himself. So all novices in all tough, high-status organizations were hazed before they could be accepted as part of the team. Men always tested men before they trusted men. If a woman isn't being hazed, she's not being tested, and therefore she's not being trusted.
Now, wait a minute. Are you telling men that you think that hazing is good?
No, it used to be helpful for men to disconnect from their feelings in order to be able to handle their job. But if we want men to be free to also have jobs that are fulfilling, we have to be okay with men not spending time disconnecting from their feelings and denying what they want to be. I think we must realize, though, that male hazing was not an outcome of men being powerful, but it's an outcome of men making themselves part of the machine, part of the team, like in the military, and not taking things personally was a part of that. I think women are more inclined to protest criticism and hazing because fewer women have ever been trained to think of themselves as a replaceable part, especially in the workplace. So historically, the defenses that men created to be able to handle hazing was their armor, but it was armor that allowed other people not to have to wear armor.
Another myth of power.
Very much so.
Tell me, though, Warren, what would you say is the single most important solution a woman can employ who believes she's being harassed?
Tell the man directly, privately, and compassionately how it makes you feel, how it makes you feel less productive and less valued. Almost every woman I know who has approached a man and told him in this way has found the man apologizing.
Okay, we've gotten our way through this whole minefield of sexual harassment. Let's try the politics of rape.
Upping the ante here, huh?
The first thing that you challenged in the rape chapter was the belief that rape was an outgrowth of male power.
Correct. the reason any given black man is three times as likely to be reported a rapist as a white man is not because blacks have more power than whites. You remember the Flint, Michigan example we talked about before? I think that's a really clear example that rape does not derive from power. It derives from powerlessness.
Okay.
We're basically a society that we addict boys to beautiful women.
We addict them.
We bombard them with thousands of images of the beautiful woman. If we did this with cocaine, we'd all consider that addiction. And then suddenly, after we addict the boys to the beautiful women, we deprive them of what they're addicted to. And it's that one-two punch that leaves men feeling powerless, leaves men feeling addicted and then deprived.
And then we're amazed when the men who are most deprived and have the least to lose seem to strike out to get more of what they're deprived of.
Exactly.
But haven't we been told over and over again that rape has nothing to do with sexual attraction?
We've been told that, and it's not accurate. When a woman is older, she's much less likely to be raped than when she's younger. When I say much less likely, I mean 8,400% less likely. She's 8,400% more likely to be raped when she's younger than when she's much older.
In other words, when a woman is very young and at the height of her sexual attractiveness, she's far more at risk at rape. So there must be something, as far as attractiveness is concerned, going on and why she's more at risk?
That's exactly right.
Tell me more about that. And the assertion that we've heard so much of, that rape is really just an act of violence.
It is an act of violence, but it's not just an act of violence. Violence is the end result of a whole series of things that we do to men and women in the society around the issue of sexuality. It's a result of a society that addicts men to beauty, the beautiful woman, and addicts men to sex with beautiful women. And then it deprives men of the sex with the beautiful women that they've just addicted them to, which of course creates anger. It tells men that sex is dirty, and then it says to men, you guys, you initiate the dirt. And then it wonders why we don't trust men who initiate something that is dirty. So it's made men insecure by having to initiate something at the age of 13 or 14. They have to initiate sex before they even know what sex is and before they even understand what a woman is. They, during the days of their greatest amount of fragility of identity, have to be putting their identity on the line and risking rejection. They're the only sex that has to do that by expectation, not by option. So we tell men, we've addicted you to this sex with a beautiful woman. We're going to deprive you of what you're addicted to. We're not going to trust you. Initiate the dirt. And then wonder why they get angry, feel rejected, feel fragile, feel insecure, feel powerless, and eventually strike out.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that rape is a result of anger, and it is an act of violence, but it also has very much factored into it whether or not a man is feeling sexually attracted to a woman.
Yes, it's part of the whole inundation of expectations and addictions that we do to men combined with the deprivations. And it's all of that together that we have to address if we're going to stop rape.
Well, is part of what you're suggesting that we need to do in order to reduce rape is to reduce a constant inundation that men get with images of female beauty and sexuality?
Yes, if I was at a PTA meeting and I said, listen, it's harmless, I'm sure. We're going to introduce your children every day to images of cigarettes and cocaine. No problem, right? I mean, the parents would say, wait a minute, this is going to addict our children to cigarettes and cocaine. We don't want children to grow up this way. But we do this every day with beautiful women's sexuality, and then we wonder why our boys are addicted to it. We don't even think about the fact that it might be related to what we're doing.
I remember in your book that you point out that all of the images that boys see from a very young age in magazines and television commercials is always of females, is always the very young, attractive females. Is that boys are constantly bombarded with images that say, see you male, that is the kind of woman that we want you to be addicted to, that you're supposed to be going after. But what I wonder, Warren, I know that you have a lot of empathy for the women's position on these issues. Isn't date rape a valid issue?
Of course. Going out with a woman does not mean you can have and should be able to have sex with her. It should be something that is a matter of communication between the two sexes. I also feel that on college campuses in particular, we've taken that woman as victim situation to the extreme where we're making women into children. For example, college campuses, especially the most responsible and brightest ones, are increasingly adopting policies that allow a woman to drink in the evening, say yes to sex, and then declare the following morning that she was raped, based on the rationale that because she drank, she was under the influence, and therefore she was incapable of consenting. I have to tell you, I think that is the most blatant form of woman as child legislation that I have ever encountered.
Woman as child?
Yes, it basically denies that the woman made a choice to drink. When people make a choice to drink and drive, we don't say that the accident wasn't their fault because they were, quote, under the influence. The shocking thing is that this is happening at universities training the best and brightest women, women supposedly being trained to take the most responsibility, for example, in the world of business, who should be being trained to take the most responsibility sexually, not the least. Being under the influence is no excuse to avoid responsibility, the responsibility of making the choice to be under the influence and the responsibility for what comes afterwards. Men feel under the influence the moment they see a beautiful woman. Perfumes even promise to put men under the influence. Allowing a woman to not take responsibility because she's under the influence opens the gateway for allowing men not to take responsibility for having sex with a beautiful woman because he's under the influence.
Let's take a look at another part of all this, the statistics that show huge increases in the rate of rape. What's going on here?
The rape rate has actually been decreasing. It decreased until we changed the definition of rape to include date rape and even unwanted sexual activity. So we used to define rape as stranger rape. Now it's defined by many feminists even as unwanted sexual activity. But the problem with that is that even surveys of college students who are men find that 94% of men feel that they've had unwanted sexual activity, and even by the age of college years. So what we've done is claim that there is an increase in rape, when in fact what we've done is changed and broadened the definition. So if we had asked that same question 30 or 40 years ago, we probably would have gotten even higher statistics along those lines.
It sounds like one of the things that you're saying is that when we make this definition so broad, that we risk trivializing the whole issue.
Right. Well, we'll be having 10 years from now the word rape be something that doesn't have the same impact on someone's mind. It feels sort of they've become desensitized to it because of the overusage of it.
One of the really shocking sections of your book concerned false allegations of rape. Tell me, if you would, the findings from the U.S. Air Force study.
Yes, first of all, false allegations of rape are basically the male experience of rape because it just ruins his life to be accused of rape falsely. And I must say probably the most shocking finding of my book concerned the Office of Special Investigations of the U.S. Air Force investigating 566 cases of alleged rape and discovering that 27% of the women eventually admitted that they had lied.
27%?
Yes, usually they admitted it just before they took or just after they took a lie detector test. The Air Force then took these 27% of women who admitted that they had lied, developed 25 criteria that were common to these women, and then they went back and they reviewed all the remaining cases with these 25 criteria in mind. They had three independent reviewers from in and outside the Air Force review all these cases, and if all three reviewers agree that the rape allegations appeared to be false based on these 25 criteria, they ranked those rapes as likely to be false as well.
Okay.
And when they did that, they got 60% of rapes allegations as likely to be false.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing, and it's also sad for both sexes, because these are the women that are supposed to be the ultimate examples of women in this country who are taking responsibility, saying that they're willing to put their lives on the line for their country.
Can you share the main motivations given by that 27% of the women who eventually acknowledged that they had made false allegations? What did they say about why they did that?
There were about eight motivations listed, and the main ones were spite and revenge that the women acknowledged, or to compensate for some feeling of guilt or shame. One woman I read about in the Air Force study had gone to a party, and she had sex in the backyard that evening after she met the man, but somebody saw her. She felt humiliated, and she felt her reputation was going to be ruined, so she said, well, he raped me. I became aware of this whole issue first when I met a man when I was hiking up in where I have a cabin in the mountains in Idyllwild, and he had been Sailor of the Year in 1980. And as we started talking and I told him what I was doing, he told me he had had his career ruined by a false allegation that was motivated by a woman who had fled home to avoid a drug test in the Air Force. And when she was confronted by her parents, she didn't know what to say, so she told her parents that she had been raped. That's why she had left the barrack sites. Her parents, of course, were furious. They complained to the Air Force. And the woman was believed so quickly and unquestioningly that by the time the truth came out, all the top brass were backed into a corner, and none of them wanted to admit that they were wrong. So no truth could catch the lie.
Next topic, rape shield laws. Those laws that shield a woman's sexual past from being used against her in court without shielding a man's sexual past from being used against him in court. What's your reaction to all that?
Rape shield laws are really an amazing and a flagrant violation of our constitutional right to due process, because they shield one party more than the other in a trial, and they therefore deny one party a fair trial. And they're also, therefore, obviously a violation of the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection of the Laws Clause.
I wonder if we should have you on the Supreme Court. What about laws that protect the identity of the woman accusing the man of rape?
I think we have to ask ourselves in that type of situation, why are we protecting only her identity if the very purpose of a trial is to determine who is victimized, not to assume who is victimized?
Ah.
It undermines the very purpose of a trial, and that's why it violates due process and equal protection as well. The result of this is that somebody like William Kennedy Smith can be acquitted of an accusation of date rape and yet still be held in our minds as guilty, with his reputation ruined to the degree that almost no parent would today feel very comfortable with his daughter going out with William Kennedy Smith. Yet at the same time, the person who accused him, even if it was a false allegation, had the option of keeping her identity secret forever. She takes no risk. He, even if he is a victim of a false accusation, is ruined. Once we understand that it's possible for a woman to make a false accusation, and that a false accusation is to a man the equivalent of being raped, meaning that it can ruin his career and even make his family suspicious of him, and leads in many cases to suicide, then to protect one party and expose the other is not only unconstitutional, it's also inhumane. And I think that we would only even think about doing that to a man.
Well, why would such flagrant violations be allowed by people who are sophisticated in the law?
Because even sophisticated people believe so strongly in female innocence that we were only able to conceive that a woman accusing a man of rape could have nothing but pure motivations. And therefore, once you start with that belief, any additional stress we put on somebody with pure motivations would be adding to her victimhood. So our instincts to protect an innocent woman are so much stronger than our instincts to give a fair trial. And they are stronger than our instincts to allow men equal protection under the law, which is why so few people question male-only draft registration or the 12 female-only defenses.
What do you see as the solution to rape?
I think the most important single change we can make is re-socializing women to initiate sexually, to take responsibility for saying what they do want, not just what they don't want. Simultaneously, I think we need to resocialize men to pay attention to women's no's and make a woman who doesn't mean her no live with the consequences of not being able to enjoy sexual contact.
We're getting real close to having to sum all this up, Warren. What do you think are some of the most important things that you'd like people to get out of this book, The Myth of Male Power?
That's always so hard to ask someone who's worked on this thing for 10 years. I think first, an understanding the wound that unifies all men is really the wound of our disposability, the belief that we will be more lovable if we risk our lives as soldiers in the death professions just to make more money, as a dad, as a wallet, rather than to, I guess, rather than to respect ourselves enough to know that we can become lovable merely by loving.
You mentioned also that stage two technology has reversed what humans need to do to survive.
Yes, basically stage two society has created the technology for our species to survive without killing, and that's wonderful. But it's also created the technology to end our species if we do kill. And so far what we've done is we've responded by changing only what women do to survive. For example, we've used birth control to create female biology not only as female destiny, but also as male destiny. She can choose to abort or to sue for support.
And she's the one that has the choice.
Exactly. Choosing to abort is female biology as female destiny. Choosing to sue for support is female biology as male destiny.
What do you think will be the single biggest dilemma facing a men's movement?
Unfortunately, the fact that there are very few political movements that are filled with healthy people. And yet, at the same time, there are few healthy changes that have occurred without political movements.
I know we've talked about this some already, but tell me again, why do you think we are so resistant to understanding when men are victimized?
I believe it's because men's victimizer status camouflages men's victim status. And of course, because we as men have not spoken up, and we can't expect the world to hear what men have not said. And we haven't spoken up in part because training to be a man is training to cut ourselves off from feelings so we don't get in touch with what we want to speak up about.
Cutting ourselves off from our feelings leaves us with this inability to express how we feel.
Yes, and with a women's movement without a men's movement, it would be like having a movement of management without labor or labor without management. Anytime you have one movement without some natural resistance to it, you lead to power which corrupts, and absolute power that corrupts absolutely.
If a significant men's movement does surface, what do you think will be its main issues?
I think first confronting what I call the 10 glass cellars of male disposability. The suicide we talked about, the men in prison, the homelessness, 85% being men, the men in the death professions, 94% of the people who die in jobs being men, men's earlier deaths from all 15 major diseases and causes of accidents, violence against men in the form of circumcision, corporal punishment, capital punishment, to say nothing of the draft, and so on. I think a second big issue will be fathers confronting their experience of taxation without representation. Divorced fathers who experience themselves being taxed for their children without equal representation in their children's lives. But most of all, I hope I'll live to see the day when we get beyond a women's movement or a men's movement, and we have a genuine gender transition movement. And I know that that's going to require us to care as much about saving males as we care about saving whales, and as much about helping men become stage two men as we've been caring about women becoming stage two women. I'd love to see that day before I die.
For more information about Dr. Farrell and his work, please write Warren Farrell, 103 North Highway 101, Box 220, Encinitas, 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 California, 92024.
The Myth of Male Power was written by Warren Farrell. For this audio program, Tom Howard interviewed the author. The recording engineer was Scott Higby. Tape editing by Rick Bradley, with post-production by Stephen Erickson. The associate producer was Christine Germain Nelson. The Myth of Male Power was produced and directed by Karen Frillman.